night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Welcome to the show. We're looking forward to a great one tonight as we bring back our guest, George Case. I think it was about 2 years ago that George was here. We were talking about his book, Here's to My Sweet Satan was the name of it. I had to look because I always want to say Hail. It's not Hail. It's Here's to My Sweet Satan. And it was about the occult and rock and roll. I remember it being a very, very interesting discussion. But George has several other books about other topics as well. He's written a lot about rock and roll and pop culture, which I have to be honest, I could spend all night talking about that particular topic or the variations of that topic. But we're going to talk about a couple of different things tonight. One of the things is he's written an essay about the lasting effects of the pandemic, and it's not what you think it is. That's what I find very interesting about George's perspective here. So we're going to talk about that essay and his ideas as it relates to them. We're also going to talk about Stanley Kubrick, one of the most enigmatic directors and filmmakers of our time. Directed such unbelievable films such as 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Shining, A Clockwork Orange. There's so many. I think, what was the Tom Cruise one that was Eyes Wide Shut, right? That was one of his. But there's the films are amazing unto themselves. But in addition to that, there's controversy and conspiracy related to some of Kubrick's work and Kubrick himself. And we'll be talking about that perspective with George Case tonight. And then I think finally, what was the other thing? There's something else we're going to chat about too. Well, we'll surprise you when we get to that point. Either way, it's going to be a great conversation, and I'm glad George has agreed to come back and be on the program with us tonight. Before we get into much else, though, I do want to just take a second and wish my father a happy birthday today. Now, my father left us in 2014, and he's very sorely missed. Hard to believe it was 7 years ago. But it's his birthday, and I have to thank my dad for introducing me to a love of music that has guided my life. He taught me how to play guitar, which has been a highlight of my life. He taught me a love for electronics and computers and tinkering, which is still a passion of mine. And he also taught me to do whatever the heck I want and not give a shit about what anybody else thinks. And I have to thank him for that, too, because that has been a really, really valuable skill all of my life. So happy birthday, Dad. Wherever you are, I hope you're enjoying yourself. You know that whole song, if there's a rock and roll heaven, right? Rock and roll. I hope you're there. If for no other reason, then you get to enjoy all those amazing performances. Anyway, be sure to subscribe to our channels on YouTube and Twitch. Of course, Twitch is a little bit different. There's no archive of programs there, but there are live streams there of the show. And when you're on Twitch, you can follow for no charge. But if you end up subscribing, there is a fee unless you use it and link it to your Amazon Prime account. If you link it to Amazon Prime, there's no additional fee, but you just have to renew that every month. So remember to do that. On YouTube, there's no fee to subscribe. Both channels can be found by searching just my name, JV Johnson. Very, very, very simple to find. All right, let's go to break. Let's get our good friend George Case on the line here. We'll begin talking about all these topics. We have a lot to cover with George, and I'm looking forward to it. It's Beyond Reality, and we'll be right back. Hey, it's JV here. You know I've asked for your support in the past, and I'm going to do it again because it's really, really important. And there are a couple of ways you can support the show, and it's so inexpensive. Now, you can go to Patreon, and you can become a Patreon supporter, and we really, really encourage that. But there's also another way. If you look at the description of the podcast, if you're a podcast listener, and you scroll down to the bottom, there's a way to support the show directly through the podcast app. And it's only 99 cents a month. It's less than a buck. You probably have that change in your couch right now. That dollar a month, less than a dollar, goes a long way in helping us produce this program, provide great interviews for you during the course of the week. I thank you in advance because the support is so important to the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm your host, GV. Thank you to everybody for joining us. If you're a podcast listener, thank you to you as well. I know that you don't have the opportunity necessarily to join us on the live program because of the hour, but the podcast version is just as happy to be presented to you. And we are getting downloaded something around, I don't know, it's like 10,000 times a day. So thank you to all of our podcast listeners. It's a very, very convenient way for people to listen to the program if they can't catch the live version. We're excited tonight. We've got a returning guest, a good friend, George Case. He's a writer. He's the author of several books on music and pop culture. We've talked about some of those on the program before. He also has weekly essays that he posts at his personal blog, which you can find at georgecaseblog.wordpress.com. George, welcome back to Beyond Reality. It's great to have you here tonight.
Very good to hear from you.
So let's talk about what's been going on the last couple of years. I think it's been about two since you've been here, and the world is a very, very different place than it was 2 years ago.
Oh, my God, yeah. I think we are living through historic times. It's I think it may be for our generation, what I've said in my writing and just in conversation with a lot of other people, it just seems to be this generation's equivalent of World War II. I don't think we've seen a society that's been mobilized against a single enemy this much since those times against the 1940s. Now, there was the Cold War, there was Vietnam, there was 9/11. We've lived through a lot of history just in my life in the last 30, 40, 50 years. But to see so many places in the world, I'm up in Canada, you're in the U.S., Europe, Asia, Far East, Africa, South America, mobilized and shaped by this common condition, I think that is something kind of unprecedented in my lifetime, I can say.
I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I was alive during the tail end of Vietnam, obviously alive during the Gulf War, during 9/11. And, you know, we've had hot spots and trouble spots in the world in all of my lifetime. It seems like every time you turn around, there's something. There's a flashpoint somewhere. But I think with the exception of World War II, this what we're going through now probably affects more people more directly and will have longer consequences than any of those things that I just named. Maybe you can put Vietnam on a different plane. I'm not sure, but I don't think Vietnam affected as many people as this worldwide pandemic has been affecting.
Right. I mean, I think in terms of the casualties, we're probably lucky that it hasn't been like World War II in terms of sheer numbers. And I guess the closest comparison really is to the Spanish flu of just over 100 years ago. I mean, that's basically what we're living through. It's a health emergency. It's not a war. It's not an invasion from aliens. It's a global health emergency. But the extent to which it's got people not only locked down and kept in their house, but the extent to which it's got governments working against a common problem and having the entire population sort of lined up or mobilized and encouraged to live and act a certain way, the amount of resources that have gone into bailing out individual citizens, workers, businesses, the amount of government resources that have gone into healthcare and procuring the vaccines, that is something unprecedented. It's like the Manhattan Project of the 1940s, the race to build an atomic bomb, and now we're getting the same way with the vaccine and the rollout of the taking care of all the ill people, the senior citizens. It's something we haven't seen, and as you say, I think economically, politically, socially, the repercussions are going to be huge for some time. We're going to be talking about it years after we're finally finished. We're going to be looking back and thinking, well, how did this happen? What did we do right? And maybe just as importantly, what did we do wrong? In the same way we look back at World War II, it's a good thing that we won World War II. The good guys definitely won. But we may think, how did it get so far that we had to have such a war?
Yeah, that is an excellent point, and we'll be looking at this particular circumstance with that type of hindsight as well. How did it get to that point? Is there anything we could have done in the beginning to have prevented it? And you know, Monday morning quarterbacking is not always healthy, but in some cases, the analysis that can come from that can lead to prevention of similar circumstances down the road. Do you think? And I know you've written about some conspiracy stuff in some of your essays, and obviously, we're going to talk about Stanley Kubrick tonight. There's conspiracy theories associated with him. But my question, and if you don't have an opinion on this, that's fine too. But a lot of people are concerned with the speed at which the vaccine for COVID was developed. And, you know, I don't think most sane people don't dispute the data, but I guess some people would say, how do we know the long-term effects of this vaccine when we haven't had any long-term studies? It was developed and injected in people's arms all within a year. Do you have any concerns about anything like that?
Not. My concern is more that whether or not they're really effective, mm-hmm. whether or not they're necessary, whether, again, I have no claims to be a medical expert. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an immunologist. So to a large extent, I do trust that the authorities, and again, this is governments all over the world. It's not just one single government. I do trust that there's a basic pool of resources and better minds than mine trying to work on this and who have determined that this is the thing to do. But as with any kind of immunization or inoculation, there may be side effects. It may just not even work that well. So we're always coming up against new types of diseases. That's just the nature of bacteria and how these things evolve. So there's always going to be some new virus or some new health concern that can affect people and that can kill people that medicine just has not got on top of. So it's my concern with immunization is less that there's some sort of agenda behind it or something that we're not being told. It's more that, is this really going to work, and is there going to be something else coming down the road that's going to be just as deadly and which this vaccination won't be able to contain? So I'm not sure about whether we can trust any kind of technology all the way through the rest of our lives, whether or not this is really the solution to anything, and we'll go back to our pre-pandemic life really soon. I think this may be some kind of condition that we may have to be living with indefinitely. There's going to be a constant sort of a cold war against the viruses right now, the same way we had a World War II followed by a cold war against another political enemy. Maybe we'll have a cold war against another health enemy. That remains to be seen. But as far as, you know, do I trust the people who are making the vaccines? Do I think there's something else in there? Sure, I think people are generally doing their best in a problem against an unprecedented problem, but whether all these people's best is the best we need or the best that we can do, that remains to be seen.
You're right. Time will tell. I'll answer a lot of these questions, and hopefully they answer them in a way that we all can be happy and live with. Because yeah. It was a miracle of science to have this vaccine develop so quickly, and it seems to be, based on the numbers that are being presented, very, very effective. So I applaud the companies that put their researchers to work on this, and and the federal government for kind of providing its support and getting regulations out of the way to make it happen, because this could be the miracle we're looking for, and I think we all have our fingers crossed that it is.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's coming out in Canada. People are getting vaccinated. I know it's throughout the States and throughout other countries, too. It's people are putting it to use, and it seems to be, the initial studies seem to say that it may be effective, so maybe this will get us back to normality. Maybe this is the weapon, the battle we need to win. Maybe this is the end of the war, but again, history will show just how effective it was or wasn't.
George, do you even know what normal is anymore? I don't. I'm not even sure.
Good question.
I'm not even sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether or not even by the end of this year or later this summer we'll think this is something we can forget. I think we're going to be living with the consequences of it a long time, if not necessarily in the realm of health, but certainly in terms of media, in terms of politics, in terms of education and work, like the idea of people working from home more and more, long-distance travel. Do people want to get on airplanes? Do kids want to be in school? How are university students going to be educated? Are they going to go to classrooms? All these things are still up in the air right now. So whether we're simply on a pause button and then once the vaccines have been distributed, we can hit that and sort of resume everything that we were living in 2019, I don't know if that's going to come back.
We're going to talk a lot about a lot of different aspects of your work tonight, but I kind of want to get an overview here. Your books kind of speak for themselves. The titles basically tell you what the books are about. But tell us a little bit about the blog. What type of topics do you like to write about on your blog?
Well, the blog is kind of a platform for all of my other books, and it does cover things like there's book reviews, there's music reviews, there's little opinion pieces. I kind of think that what you would find on my blog is something you might find in a newspaper or a magazine, just short essay, takes 5 minutes to read about something that's going on that's current. Sometimes I just write a sort of humor piece or a reflection piece, something about from my life. A lot of times it's a consideration about some of my favorite type of music. I'm an old classic rocker, and I've written books about Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and that era of music with Beatles. Sometimes it's about politics. I have a whole category of stuff about culture and about film. I've written about Stanley Kubrick, so I've reviewed some of his movies or his influence. But it's the subtitle of the blog is Essays and Ideas, so I'm kind of open to all kinds of things that maybe provoke people or just my own take on what's going on in the world, and hopefully without being inflammatory or overly partisan, or it's not there to stir people up and get people angry. It's to get people thinking.
It seems like it takes very little to get people stirred up and angry these days.
Absolutely.
One word put in a place that, you know, might seem inappropriate for somebody else. It's just that people get all riled up. It's really amazing how thin our skin has gotten. But I guess that's just part of the times we're living in. I want to kind of start a conversation here talking about one of your books. And this is one that was published about 10 years ago. It's called Dumbing Down Dissent. Tell me what that book's about.
That's a collection of pieces on politics and culture. And what I was looking at with that book was sort of the way protest has turned, to me, overly simplistic. The subtitle I've got, or the tagline I've used, is How Has Critical Thinking Become So Thoughtless? So I do take on things like conspiracy theories. I take on things like people's criticism of the media. As a Canadian writer, I take on something that's very common up here in Canada, is a kind of reflexive criticism of the United States. So I was trying to get into all these things, and again, without taking a side either left or right, it's more about serious versus shallow. Like, if we're going to have a political conversation and serious political debates, let's at least set a reasonable sort of constructive framework that we can talk about things in, so that we're not falling back on all these kind of cliches and shallow thinking about what the problem is and what the solution is. Because it seems to me that, well, as you say, people do have thin skins, people are very partisan, people are certainly very polarized in Canada and the U.S. and other parts of the world. So let's at least try to restore some kind of semblance of civility and constructiveness to our political debates. We can still disagree on stuff, but let's not fall back on just simplistic thinking. So that's what Dumbing Down Dissent is. Absolutely, we need dissent, but let's keep it smart and let's keep it thoughtful.
And I knew the answer to that question before I asked it, but I wanted you to explain it as you just did so that I can ask this follow-up question. In the 10 years since you published that particular book, based on the things that you just outlined, media, political discourse, all of these things, what kind of changes have you seen over these 10 years?
I think it certainly has gotten more polarized. I think people are more inclined to look at their ideological opponents almost as personal enemies. We don't seem to have a lot of common ground anymore. We certainly don't seem to have a lot of common facts. People tend to be very siloed in their own media world, so they get only the information that agrees with what they already like. And that's certainly a function of social media. I think that we tend to get a lot of feeds that just kind of reinforce the convictions we already have, whether from left or right. So there's not a lot of what people call reaching across the aisle just among regular citizens, where a Democrat and Republican can sit down and talk and find some sort of common ground, or in Canada, a Liberal and a Conservative. There's kind of it's almost become a lifestyle thing where your politics is so connected to your personality and to your social situation that there's just no way you could even consider what the other side has to say. So that polarization, I think, has become pretty much worse, and I think there's less trust in the democratic process of people voting and our legislators kind of hashing things out and coming to a compromise that's for something that can benefit everyone. There's a lot of rhetoric about we've got to take back our country, as if the other people who live in it with us aren't entitled to have it. And that's bad for democracy if we've got people thinking that all those other citizens we share the land with don't really deserve to have it. So I think that's been pretty unhealthy. And the invoking dissent to say that, you know, I'm against X and I'm standing up to this big monolith of power, whoever it is, whether it's left or right, that doesn't leave much room for engagement with the other side and constructive debate and, you know, let's get together and sort this out and maybe come to some sort of common terms. There's a lot of posturing and a lot of hostility between people, and I think we've seen it. I mean, the States is kind of a bellwether for the rest of the world, in that there's, I think, a legitimate concern that there's the social divides may even lead to violence, to real political divides that just can't be bridged anymore. So I don't think it's got better. I'll put it that way.
You summed it up so very eloquently, and you really kind of painted a picture that I think a lot of us are seeing and a lot of us are frustrated with. And I'm going to nail down a little deeper here. In 2010, 11, you know, when you were writing and getting the book published, we already saw some carnage in the media landscape from the effects of the internet. In 2021, that carnage now looks like a nuclear wasteland. There are virtually no newspapers left. There are just a few, a handful. I owned radio stations for a lot of years, so I'm very familiar with the radio business, and that business has been decimated. You know, radio stations are still on the air, but they don't have news departments. They very rarely have actually live talent in the studio, providing whatever format they're providing. And the same thing with television stations. And I'm not talking about cable, but I'm talking about independent television stations. They just do not thrive anymore. So the wasteland the devastation has turned into a complete nuclear wasteland of the media. How is that affecting all of this?
Well, like I say, if we're getting our news or our ideas or what we think of as news from a social media feed, where people are just putting up a blog or any kind of site that doesn't have actual on-the-ground reporters, like you mentioned, there's no actual, and the ones that are out there, no one trusts, or people only trust the ones that convey something that already corresponds with what they believe. The idea of objective facts and expert authority, and this is something I've got into some of my other books too, but the idea that there's some independent, objective, trustworthy source that everyone can kind of agree on, even if we disagree on the consequences or the impact of that news. The fact that we don't even agree on what is news anymore,
yeah,
I think, is really problematic for a society where everyone is just siloed in their own bubble and only getting the information that corresponds with their pre-existing prejudices. That's really harmful. And, of course, the social media itself tends to reinforce or sort of amplify prejudices you already have, so that even the most fringe element, something that would just never really be considered 20 or 30 years ago, can attract an audience and drag people into the rabbit hole simply by just sort of serving as clickbait and getting people interested and intrigued, and often just getting them angry, without offering any real analysis or real facts on the ground. It's just stirring people up. And that, and again, that goes across the board from left to right. It's, I think all sides are pretty guilty of it. But now we're just seeing people living in, it is an information landscape, but in terms of objective truth or serious reporting or substantial data that we can all agree on, yeah, it's a wasteland.
It really is. And then you add one more layer to that, and this is something that I think is going to come to a head, if not this year, in the next couple of years, and it's the dominance. You keep mentioning social media, which is obviously a powerful force in this whole discussion. Google isn't necessarily social media, but it is a conduit of information, and they control a hell of a lot of information that flows to people. In fact, you know, the name of the company, Google, has become, you know, an accepted word in the English language to mean that you're looking up information. You know, and then you've got, you know, Facebook, which I don't necessarily put quite in the same ballpark as Google. Google owns YouTube. You've got a few companies here that are really have a stranglehold on the flow of information. And when they decide that certain information shouldn't be seen, you don't see it. And I don't know, you know, I'm not sure how to digest this. Have you given any thought to this dilemma, and should we be concerned about it?
Yeah, well, I do think a lot of people have raised those concerns about Google and Facebook and Twitter, that these are becoming the tech giants, almost like the robber barons of the train era. Like, these people control so much that these are big trusts that need to be busted. That's been discussed in Europe and Canada and other parts of the world. Like, are these companies just too big? Are they too powerful? And should they be broken up and for everyone's benefit? In the same way that any large company is just, if it becomes too dominant, can control the market for anything, whether it's trains or travel or any other product. And now it is information. You know, I'm not sure that we owe it to, or we can expect all these media companies that they're the ones who should be giving out information, and we have to see that they're giving out or letting us access the right information. I've always said, and this is something I do say in Dumbing Down Dissent, is that it's the responsibility of the citizen to look stuff up. Like, it's not necessarily hidden or kept from us. If you want to find out something, you can go to a good public library. There's a lot of good places to make yourself informed about any particular subject. If you're just getting it, if you were ever getting it from a soundbite on the TV news, if you were getting it from the front page of your local paper when we had them, and now if you're getting it just by clicking on a Google or a Facebook link, you know, you're not getting a very informed picture of the situation, and you're not being a really informed citizen. So I think we owe it all to ourselves to take the responsibility to find stuff out on our own instead of just letting it come to us and trusting whatever source we have. We have to do a little bit of the digging ourselves. So it's not all on the media itself, whether it's TV networks or radio or now the internet and the big tech giants that we have today. It's up to us. The power is still with us as citizens and consumers of news to go out and look up stuff rather than just let it come to us through a curated feed that we assume is going to give us all the facts. But you do have to dig a little to find out stuff and become an educated and informed citizen.
I think that's a great point. However, I'll add this one caveat to that idea. Again, going back to what I said about the media landscape, you know, 30 years ago, just to give you an example, in my little town, I grew up in a town called Oneonta, New York, about 15,000 people. There were three newspapers. There were two competing radio stations that both had full-time news staffs. There was no TV station because the town was just too small. However, but that even just that little town, there were five separate news sources that I could go to get varying opinions about whatever the story of the day was. And in those cases, it most likely was local or regional news that I was looking for, or my parents were, because I was probably too young. But either way, the point is, there are a lot of choices, but all of those choices are gone in the town that I grew up in. They're all gone. So you don't have those options anymore. And you multiply that across the entire United States and then across the entire world. So these companies that are now dominating the information flow are also the same companies that put all of the competing ideas and the competing information out of business, with the exception of a few. There are still some out there. But those numbers have dwindled to a point where there aren't many dissenting opinions. And a lot of the media that still exists is owned by corporate conglomerates that all
present the same message. So you're not getting varying opinions, despite the fact you might go to CNN or you might go to MSNBC or you might go to ABC or whatever it happens to be. You know, many of them are owned by the same people, so it's the same message. So I guess that is the bigger fear to me, is that these guys came in, they dropped the nuclear bomb on the landscape, they control everything, and democracy can't function without information. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. We need to have, for democracy, we need to have informed citizens and we need to have trusted source of information. But the paradox is that the government can't sort of mandate that.
Absolutely.
Nobody
right.
can mandate
that's
that
right.
and say, here's the information, here's the sources that you need, and that's all. So I hear you about the shrinking media landscape and the loss of local journalism, for sure. But I would always, even before all that happened, I would have said that for anyone who wants to find out what's going on, we owe it to ourselves to get an education, like learn about elementary civics, learn about how your government works, learn about the world, so you can at least, whatever comes to you, whether it's through the old sources of the legacy media, like the TV and radio stations of yesteryear or now, through Google and Wikipedia and Facebook, at least have some background so that you know, you have a sense of what you can trust, what's authoritative, what's reliable, and what other alternate sources may be out there. Because I don't think, the problem isn't that things are being censored so much. The problem is we've got a glut of information. It's like the metaphor people always use is you're trying to drink from a fire hose. You're not going to get a healthy glass of water putting your face to a fire hose. You have right. to learn to sort of curate and select and judge the sources you do get. And that involves a little bit of effort on your part as a citizen, on my part as a citizen, to know what's out there and get a bit of a grounding, because I don't think anything's really being held from us or prevented, but it's a matter of knowing what to trust and what to look for, what is how to think, basically.
Excellent points. So all of this kind of introduction and bringing up your book from 10 years ago was my way to kind of lead us to this next topic. And that's something you wrote more recently, which is an essay called Get Up, Stand Up. And it discusses the lasting effects of the global pandemic. But, you know, most people would automatically assume, well, yeah, lasting effects. There are economic effects, lasting effects. There are health effects. But you took a completely different approach on this. And I really like what you said and how you wrote about this. Tell us what that particular essay is talking about.
Well, yeah, the point of the essay was that it seems to me, and we go back to that comparison to World War II, which it seems to me that was the last time in history, and that was basically our grandparents' age, where people were sort of encouraged to support a single cause, and everyone get on the team, and let's fight the common enemy, and we're all united for a single purpose. But ever since World War II, for the last all through the 50s, certainly the 60s and the 70s, and you know, really right up to very recently, the common message we were getting from our media and from our films and our classic literature and from so many sources was the idealization of rebellion, of dissent, of being the lone holdout. And that could be anyone from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Winston Smith in 1984, from Number Six in The Prisoner to Hawkeye Pierce on MASH. We've always been kind of idealizing that lone rebel voice. But suddenly with the pandemic, the message we're getting from so many sources is, no, everyone get in line, wear your masks, socially distance, stay at home, stay in the bubble. So it's a real kind of 180 degrees from so many of the stories, the encouragement we've been grown up with. And I'm just, it seemed to me when I was writing the essay, I thought, well, this is kind of a real reversal, and it's hard. Maybe young people today, people who are in their teens, can kind of get on board a lot quicker because it's newer to them and they're more willing to accept all these restrictions, the quarantine, the lockdown, the working from home or schooling from home, walking the proper way down the grocery aisle. But for people who are a bit older and who have lived through, you know, the 60s, the 70s, where so many of the messages was about protest and push back and get up, stand up, and don't give up the fight, there's kind of a disconnect between what we're hearing now from our authorities and our governments telling us to trust and obey and conform versus all those other messages that said nonconformity is the good thing and you don't want to be a conformist. So it's been a real adjustment culturally, I think, for all of us to feel that we suddenly have to obey the rules after generations of being told that rules were meant to be broken.
You know, it's interesting, when I was reading the piece, you do an amazing job of kind of tiptoeing up to what I guess I would call a political line, you know, left or right. And you get to the line and then you kind of go to the other line, you go to the other way and you get to that line and you kind of come back. So I found it a very balanced art, very balanced piece, which was refreshing. You know, you mentioned teenagers being a little bit more willing to accept these kind of restrictions. And I think there's something at play there that we don't often think about. Kids are being taught differently in school when they go to school. A lot of kids aren't going to school right now, but when they were, they're being taught very differently. And one of the, you know, these, I guess, conformist messages that they're getting are kind of like do your part messages. And those do your part messages come up in things like, you know, the climate change discussion. And I don't want to get into climate change itself, but, you know, there's a lot of this. The kids are hearing a lot of this. And in some cases, you know, some of this social engineering, some of these things that we're hearing now that, in many ways are disturbing, that are social issues that are now being incorporated into school curricula. Those are also kind of, I guess I would say, you know, march in line, do it this way because this is the right way, as opposed to those individualistic ideas that may have been accepted and I don't know about taught, but certainly accepted previously.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have kids in school myself. I'm a parent. And I see them coming home with the lessons that they're receiving. And, you know, every generation looks back on what their kids are learning and thinks, maybe find something to critique there.
Right.
But definitely there is a sense that things that maybe for older people in their 40s and 50s, 30s, 40s and 50s, might have thought were questionable, where there was room for debate, now have become strictly black and white. And by comparison, things that we thought were sort of absolute, either right or wrong, one way or the other, are now for younger generations are kind of gray areas where there's a lot more ambiguity about what is the right thing. So, and that's probably been going on forever, but it is true that today's generation are learning a certain amount of, it seems to me, a certain amount of kind of lockstep rigidity that this is the way it is, and if you question it, you're a bad person. I mean, we can get into the whole cancel culture debate, which has now become so common that people are talking about, that, you know, if you have one dissenting or deviant opinion, you're absolutely shunned and locked out of your social media. That's something, it hasn't happened to me, so I don't want to overstate the problem, but it's certainly an issue that people are talking about, that freedom of thought and freedom of expression is now more of a complicated subject, and it is something that people have raised a few red flags about. Like, we do need to have a free market of ideas out there, and if that market gets constrained or people are clamping down on what can be said, what can be expressed, what can be thought in the name of some higher cause, then it isn't democracy, it's not healthy, and it's certainly not what we think of as sort of small L liberal discourse. I don't mean liberal politically, but just liberal meaning free. Yeah. Some of that has been, I think, a little bit constrained, and maybe somewhere in today's generations, of the young generations, there may be a few dissenting voices coming out of that. But right now, it does seem like the news we're getting, the stories we're hearing, is about ideological conformity more than free exchange of ideas. That's happening in high schools, elementary schools, certainly on university campuses, where a lot of the controversies are coming from.
You know, I have to say I'm a little bit disappointed in the list of examples of individuals showing individuality and maybe a little bit of rebellious nature, and you included Hawkeye Pierce there from MASH. Somebody you included in the article, which you didn't include in the list you just gave, is Miles Burnell, Dr. Miles Burnell, from the movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is one of my all-time favorites, the 1957 version. I like the later one, too, with Donald Sutherland, but that 1957 version. one of my favorite all-time movies. When I saw you listed that in there, I thought, oh, yeah, 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 this is excellent.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you remember in the film, like, he's the one guy who sees that there's a problem and that all his neighbors are sort of being replaced by these pod people, and he's the one voice who's, and everyone thinks, you know, are you crazy? And he's, of course, he's the hero of the film, the one dissenter, the one rebel against this mass alien invasions, and he's the guy we want to identify with as the audience. We want to think that if everyone was suddenly changing or turning into a certain type of lockstep conformity, we'd be the one guy who would notice it and hold out and break free from it. But I'm not sure if there's a Miles Bunnell existing right today.
Yeah, and you know, and as you're telling this, and I don't know why it didn't dawn on me before, that film is also frequently talked about as being a social commentary on communism. However, we could really apply some of those ideas and those lessons to some of these things we're seeing today. I mean, it's very, very ominous when you start thinking about it in those terms.
Sure. I mean, at the time, when it was made in the 50s, it was sort of a metaphor for whether it was communist invasion or even like the McCarthyism.
Right.
That if everyone was suddenly down on, you know, thinking one way about trusting your neighbors, and he was the one sort of holdout, like, there was a commentary there or a metaphor against that, the Red Scare. So he was that one sort of liberal dissenter, small L liberal, the free thinker of the time. But of course, you could use all kinds of different metaphors in the years that have happened since, whatever views that are becoming so prevalent that everyone is expected to agree on and get behind. And if there's one guy whose body hasn't been snatched, who's you know, resisted the alien invasion, he's going to be that, he or she will be that Miles Bunnell figure, the one person who sees how everyone else has been changed and has been sort of, you know, bullied or moved, persuaded into some sort of lockstep mindlessness. And if he's the one who can see it and the only guy, that person will be sort of the anti-hero or the rebel of our own time. But you could use all kinds of political or social metaphors now, I think, to make the same story, but it would be commenting on a different set of circumstances.
You know, again, drawing on your experience in exploring and discussing and writing about some conspiracy theories and ideas, another thing that is becoming a little bit concerning to people is that the government response to COVID, these lockdowns, these very, very strict lockdowns in some places, may be a precursor. And I just saw a headline of an article today that even indicates that this might be true or might have some implications, but maybe a precursor to the use of similar tactics in the fight against, and I put fight in quotes, climate change or some of these other issues that are being floated as, you know, pandemic type problems. Does any of that scare you, concern you, or do you think it's all hogwash?
I wouldn't say it's hogwash. I mean, the one thing that is more immediately likely, I think, that people have talked about is pandemic or vaccination passports, where in order to travel,
that's
or
right,
even within your own country, you'll have to show that you've been vaccinated against COVID, which has raised, among civil libertarians, people have started talking about, you know, how much of our health information should be made public and how much access to our personal information should be given to the state to allow us to do stuff. I'm not sure if, I don't know if we can have a complete ideological sort of quarantine in the same way we're having it now with the health care, so that you absolutely cannot do X in the name of fighting climate change or in the name of social justice. I think the underlying tradition of civil liberties and free speech in democracies like ours is probably a bit too strong, so I don't think the government could quite take over that much and dictate exactly how we live for something that wasn't a health emergency. Because at least with COVID, we can understand that it does directly kill people. It's a virus. It's a identifiable medical condition, whereas ideas are a lot harder to regulate. But, yeah, something like a vaccination passport and some other type of security issues, I think we could at least foresee. I mean, we've been living in a kind of national security state even since 9/11. When you think about going through airport checkouts and getting across the border between Canada and the U.S., I mean, that's so different, and that's been different for 20 years because of and the amount of surveillance that we've had everywhere, cameras everywhere, and that precedes the pandemic that we're living through now. But the idea of our liberties being restricted in the name of some sort of higher cause, whether it's security or fighting terrorism, fighting the pandemic, fighting global warming, yeah, those are legitimate issues, and I wouldn't be surprised if people still raise red flags in the coming years about, you know, how much are we willing to give up of our privacy and of our freedom in the name of some idealized security.
Yeah, and just let me just mention the article that I saw. The headline is Mark Morano: Lockdowns Are Essentially a Model for Green New Deal's Planned Recession. In case anybody was interested in that, let's change the topic. Let's talk about Stanley Kubrick, because you know, just as I said that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is one of my favorite films, I think there's three or four Kubrick films that fall onto my list of favorite films, and not just because they're great films, but because Kubrick himself is such an interesting figure. How important is Kubrick's work, do you think?
Well, I think he's probably the best-known English-language filmmaker or American filmmaker of the 20th century, and that's including Spielberg and Hitchcock and Scorsese. I think he's the guy who made art films in the English language. I mean, you had your Ingmar Bergman, Federico Fellini. Like, there's a lot of great cinematic talents, but a lot of them weren't working out of the U.S. But Kubrick, he was American. He worked mostly in England in the last years of his life. But he brought to big-budget Hollywood studio films the same kind of art house sensibility that you would have seen in a lot of lower-budget European movies. So he was certainly a visionary, certainly original. And, of course, his movies, just about all of them, have become indelible parts of popular culture. Even if you don't know Stanley Kubrick or haven't seen the movies, you probably recognize a lot of the images from them, whether it's Slim Pickens riding the bomb in Dr. Strangelove, or Alex and the Droogs in The Clockwork Orange, little Danny Torrance going around the halls in The Shining, Moonwatcher in 2001 throwing the bone and it becoming a spaceship. We all know those images, whether or not we quite connect them to Stanley Kubrick, but those were all the product of one guy. So, yeah, it's pretty immense legacy.
There are a couple films that come to mind when we start talking about conspiracy theories and ideas associated with his work. But before we get into them, we know that Kubrick has some of this attached to him, but was he a controversial figure at all as an individual? Was he a political activist? Did he do anything in his personal life that might tip his hand a little bit to the fact that these conspiracy ideas circle around his films?
No, I think, I mean, having written about him and read up in his biography, he was more actually ordinary than a lot of people think. He was certainly kind of reclusive. He didn't live in Hollywood. He didn't go to awards shows. He wasn't really a celebrity. He was very low-key that way. But he was just a very well-read guy. He really delved into the material of whatever films he was working on. So if he was working about a film about space, he learned everything that there was going on at the time in the 60s of the space race and that sort of technology. When he was working on Dr. Strangelove, he read everything he could about nuclear deterrence and the Cold War. So when he was working on The Shining, he read everything about gothic fiction and horror novels. So he was a very smart guy. I don't think he had any blatant political biases one way or the other. I think he grew up in the middle of the 20th century. He was a good sort of American, thoughtful, middle-of-the-road person, a moderate. I mean, you can see there was a lot of anti-war messages in Full Metal Jacket, in Dr. Strangelove. He was a humanist, basically. Clockwork Orange is about the power of the state and technology to render an ordinary person into an automaton, like as you were mentioning before, just based on sort of aversion therapy or some kind of mental training. So he was a humanist in that sense, but he wasn't, one way blatantly left or right in his beliefs.
When did the – let's talk specifically about the controversy surrounding the idea that the moon landings may have been faked and Kubrick may have had something to do with providing the footage that ultimately was sold as being footage of men walking on the moon, effectively. When did those ideas start to surface? Was it contemporaneous? Did it happen when those images were first seen, or did this come later?
Well, 2001 came out in 1968, which was a year before the Neil Armstrong moon landing. And, of course, at the time, those were pioneering special effects.
That's right.
And Kubrick invested a lot of his time, like half the budget or more than half the budget of that movie was put into the special effects. And even people who were kind of didn't get it or found it too long or too dry, everyone acknowledged that those special effects were, you know, the most realistic, spectacular depictions of space travel that anyone had ever seen. And they still hold up pretty well today. I mean, they're made with analog, they're made with miniatures, not with the CGI that we'd use today, but they still look pretty believable. And they do have characters and objects landing on the moon, and it looks pretty realistic. So I think shortly after the moon landing, with all the real moon landing, with all the expense that went into it, I think there was, at the fringes of discourse, some thought that because only two or three astronauts were allegedly there at the time, maybe it was something that was made in a studio just to sort of buy off the public into believing that all this effort and all this money had turned out to be successful. And maybe secretly it wasn't, but we were being plied with some sort of fake image of it just to convince us that it was all worthwhile. And of course, you've probably seen the movie, I think it was 1978, Capricorn 1.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned that because I saw it, I don't know, as a kid or as a young adult. And I just saw it on, it was on HBO Max. And the other night I watched it again for the first time, probably in 30 years. And fondly, I watched it and was thinking about all these things that we're talking about tonight because that's kind of the premise of the film.
Yeah, I think in that case they were supposedly going to Mars.
To Mars, that's right.
Once the ship itself was defective, so they couldn't go. So they hustled the astronauts out to this studio out in the desert and recreated the Martian landing and broadcast that to the world. So all the public thought, oh great, we've gone to Mars, and then they were going to somehow have the astronauts killed off at the end of the movie, so they wouldn't be able to tell the story, and that it all hinges on them getting out to reveal the truth that it was all a big fake. So I think that gave some impetus to the Kubrick legend. And just to be clear, people did actually go to the moon and did walk around up there. Stanley Kubrick is a great filmmaker, and the space depictions in 2001 are, like I say, really ahead of their time and really impressive to watch. But there's just no way that something like that could have been pulled off and not be revealed. It takes a lot of people to make a 2001, and the thought that all 100 or 200, 300 people involved in that or more, that in the intervening years one of them wouldn't have come clean, is just, it's not realistic to think that.
Yeah,
let alone all the number of people in the U.S. space program, which must be tens of thousands of people, to think
right.
that they're all somehow in on the big fake job.
That's right. One of the ideas is not that we didn't go, but that there was such a fear of disaster playing out on live TV that the NASA and the federal government didn't want to show live images. So instead they, you know, while it was happening, they actually staged it somewhere else so they could control it so that they, you know, we wouldn't see a lander blowing up and killing three astronauts or whatever, you know, possible disasters could have happened there. That's one of the ideas too.
Right. But, I mean, again, with so many of these conspiracy theories, there's a kind of logic to them that says that the conspiracy was the only thing that could have pulled it off, that, as you say, let's say they didn't want to have the public see a live demonstration of a disaster happening. So, but, of course, we've seen all kinds of things happen, disasters happen live. We saw the Space Shuttle Challenger blow up on live TV.
That's right.
Now, if they fake the moon landing in order to forestall the possibility that something was going to go wrong and everyone would see it live, well, why didn't they fake the Space Shuttle Challenger getting successfully off into space? How come that slipped under their web, whereas they covered up the moon landing. Again, it's just logically, it doesn't, it seems to make sense in hindsight, but when you think about the logic of it, there's too many holes in the plot.
Of course, later on, Kubrick made the film The Shining, another one that's on my list of my favorite films. That was 1980. Mm-hmm. Fantastic movie, whether you're a horror fan or not. It's just creepy as hell.
Yeah.
But that film was said to have contained a lot of clues whereby, supposedly, Kubrick was telling people through coded messages in that film that, yes, in fact, he was involved in a conspiracy in this moon landing hoax. And here's some subtle hints for anybody who's looking for them to tell the story. It's a great way to watch the film because it's interesting. But what do you think of all that?
Well, I think that's sort of something that we've projected on the film itself. Oh, I mean, one of the things I'm thinking of is that the little boy, Danny, is wearing a shirt that has a spaceship on it, or it says Apollo 11. It's a little kid's shirt, and somehow that's given a hint. But again, these are all like retrospectives that we can see something that fits the thesis we already have. So if we're looking for it, we'll find those patterns. And it's just like, as I wrote in one of my other books, Here's to My Sweet Satan, you can always find hidden messages if you play the record backwards.
Right.
If you believe that there's a message there, you're going to hear it. And if you believe that Kubrick was putting clues in his movies, well, you'll find those clues. But it's sort of like listening to Dark Side of the Moon while watching The Wizard of Oz. If you already know the pattern that you're going to find, you will find it there. But I don't think there's any logical way or any practical way that he could have done it and think that this was somehow going to spill the beans, but he was going to do it in a subtle way. I mean, if he wanted to really tell people, I'm sure Kubrick would have come clean directly and said, I was part of this huge plot. To leave it up to just a few clues and hope that people would get the clues just doesn't seem to really hold water as an idea.
And there's a documentary called, I think it's Room 237.
237,
Which kind of goes through these ideas and presents them. And I've watched it a few years ago, and I remember thinking on a few of them, oh, that's really cool. Then I thought, but this is a stretch. That's a real stretch.
Right. I mean, it's very entertaining to come up with this stuff, as long as it's harmless and you're not taking it too far. I think it shows the inventiveness of our own minds and how much we can get out of a great film or a great piece of music or anything like that. I think that's fine. The human mind is very original that way, and we can be really creative. But once you start actually applying these to daily life and thinking that this is a real reflection of reality, then you're getting beyond just using your imagination to come up with an interesting idea, and then it's becoming a little bit delusional at that level. And I think that's what the Room 237 implies, that if you can get this much out of a single film, it's a testament to the originality and the creativity, the genius that you can find in a movie like The Shining. That's great, but it can be taken too far.
I think where it went too far for me in Room 237 is they did one of the segments was something about the scene where Jack is at the typewriter. I'm not sure if he's typing, you know, all work and no play, that scene or what. But he's at the typewriter, and they show a couple different angles of him. And in one shot, there's a chair behind him.
The chair is gone. Yeah.
And then the other shot, the chair. I'm like, what is that? There's no message there. That's a little silly.
Right, right. I mean, so anything that's an accident is something I raised in Dumbing Down Descent, too. Like, you can come up with a conspiracy based on things that are just random accidents. And in that case, it was a continuity glitch. Like, someone in the set forgot to put the chair there. It's, you know, there's no meaning to it. And life is full of random events like that. But if you're looking at it in hindsight, and if you've got plenty of time to study it and restudy it and look over it again, sure, you can come up with a recurring pattern that seems to reinforce a belief that you already have. But we do have to acknowledge that life is actually pretty random. And even the real life that we already know, like 2 years ago, would you have predicted a big global pandemic was on the way?
Yeah,
I sure couldn't have.
Right. Yeah, so if that missing chair indicates that there's a moon landing conspiracy in some fashion, then Plan 9 from Outer Space by Ed Wood must be the blueprint to the complete UFO mystery that we've all been scratching our heads
about. Sure, yeah, why not?
Right?
I refuse to argue against that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it shows how what a good imagination can do if it's let loose.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to talk about your newest book, Taking Care of Business, A History of Working People's Rock and Roll. What's working people's rock and roll?
Well, the examples in that book I've got are bands like CCR, Lynyrd Skynyrd, AC/DC, Bruce Springsteen. Now, if you think of a lot of those artists and some of those classic songs, there is this kind of subgenre of rock, and I'm a rock fan. I like all kinds of music. I'm a jazz fan, blues, classical. But there is a subgenre of that type of rock and roll that seems to appeal to a lot of the mainstream, middle American, middle Canadian, sort of, I would almost want to say the angry white male demographic or the blue-collar demographic. A lot of people who have been kind of disenfranchised by the last 30, 40 years of economic slowdown and factory shutdown, the Rust Belt, the growth, the Brexit. So many things have happened politically and economically in our world that there's a kind of soundtrack that seems to go with that. We think of Bruce Springsteen singing about people being laid off, or John Mellencamp singing about the farm crisis in the U.S., Lynyrd Skynyrd singing "Sweet Home Alabama," or AC/DC singing about Highway to Hell and Girl Scout Rhythm. There's a kind of a particular population that seems to respond to that music and whom that music really speaks for, that it's different from punk rock or from disco or from folk rock. There's a real audience for that. These are the arena rock people. The people are into Ted Nugent. And just so we're clear, the book is well in favor of all that those artists. I'm a fan. But it does seem to reflect a certain political and social dynamic that I think is pretty prominent nowadays. So I wanted to tie in an appreciation of the music with a broader history of how rock and roll has gone from something we think of as rebellious and down with the system, and now it's become almost like a traditionalist genre. Like, a lot of older guys like rock and roll. A lot of unrepentant Southerners like Lynyrd Skynyrd or ZZ Top or the Allman Brothers. So there's a different audience there. It's not just hippies and punk rockers and juvenile delinquents. It's a lot of kind of straight ahead blue collar lunch bucket type people. That's
so,
their music.
Yeah. So I think you answered this question already, but I just want to pull it out of the larger context of the answer you just gave. Is it the lyrics that makes it this, or is it the sound? Or is it where the artists themselves grew up and how they grew up? What defines the category?
Well, it's a bit of all of that. Yeah, in some cases, it's the lyrics. There are some lyrics that are definitely saying, we're fighting against the system and I'm an independent, I'm born to run,
right,
that type of thing. In some cases, it's the music. It's just that high-energy, unpretentious guitar boogie, like classic Ted Nugent music or Aerosmith. And in some cases, it's like they're the roots of the artists themselves, whether it's Mellencamp coming from the farm areas, or even Black Sabbath coming from industrial England, where everything was, all the factories were shutting down, or Lynyrd Skynyrd, ZZ Top come from the U.S. South, which is becoming its own kind of independent entity, and more over the years as the kind of cultural center of the U.S. has gone from the Rust Belt states down to the South and the West. It can be a bit of everything, and it's I won't claim that there's an absolute definition of what this music is or who fits in and who doesn't, but we kind of know it when we hear it. Like Bob Seger is another example, a guy from Detroit singing about making Thunderbirds and turn the page, going across the landscape of Middle America. We're an American band, Grand Funk Railroad, all these songs that we kind of know speak to a certain type of audience, and for whether it's what they're singing about, how the music sounds, or what we know about the character of the the artists themselves. Even a band like AC/DC from Australia, some of those classic anthems are all about, you know, guys going out and having a good time, and there's a lot of other music that's not about that. So AC/DC speaks for that sort of the young 20-something male going to a strip bar in All of Us, and that's not for everyone. So that's a particular audience that I think the music really speaks to, and I wanted to isolate that and sort of celebrate that at the same time.
Can an artist that might not fall into those parameters, might be kind of an outsider to this, the genre that we're talking about, still have a song that falls in? And I'm thinking specifically of like Billy Joel. I wouldn't put him into that category, although he was a really blue-collar musician. However, you know, the song Allentown comes to mind
Sure. As
being a song that really sings about
these things. I mentioned that one in the book, and he's got a few, there's a few sources. There's kind of a gray area. Some artists will have an individual song or an individual album that really seems to speak to a certain generation, a certain demographic, people of a certain background. For sure, it can be a lot of individual pieces or individual one hit that someone had. So for sure, Allentown is right up there, that type of music that is sort of an anthem of a particular population.
And we you and I both know and probably lament over the fact that popular music has taken some very, very strange turns over the last 10 years, maybe 15. But is there anything being produced like this category that we're talking about today in today's music?
Well, the one thing I don't go too far into the modern era, but I do think of some people like Kid Rock, for example, who does have that kind of mix of the rap sound, but yet some of the suburban Detroit attitude. He's singing about, and he's combining, or even I think sampling some of the chords from Sweet Home Alabama
against his
own beat. So he's kind of appealing to that same audience, or the children of that original Lynyrd Skynyrd audience, and updating the sound a little bit for them. So, and I'm not a diehard Kid Rock fan by any means, but you can see that there's a tradition there that's extending from CCR, Lynyrd Skynyrd, to Kid Rock. It's appealing to the same strain of people coming from the same part of the country, listening to the same style of music and getting the same message from it, maybe.
Again, the book is called Taking Care of Business, A History of Working People's Rock and Roll. Where can people find that book and your other books, George?
They're all on Amazon.com. I think the new one, Taking Care of Business, might be at Barnes & Noble. I don't know about how, if people are still able to get into a Barnes & Noble these days, but I'm definitely online. You can go to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca in Canada, wherever you live. They are available. Won't take long to find them online. And they're Taking Care of Business has just come out. The previous one, Here's to My Sweet Satan, came out about 5 years ago, but you'll find them out there.
And your weekly blog can be found at georgecaseblog.wordpress.com. Is there any other spots that people can go to follow you, or is that the best place?
That's the best one, and I try to update that every week. I've got a new short essay up there, so you can always find out my latest thoughts on. They're not always about news or the latest some breaking story, but there's some opinion on something that's current generally. So, yeah, and it's a little quick read, nothing too impactful, but I think spend 5 minutes, you'll get some fresh ideas there.
George, this has been a great discussion. I had a lot of fun. It was informative, and I really appreciate you coming back on the program. This was a great night.
Hey, good to talk to you, man, and anytime.
Beyond Reality Paranormal is hosted by J.V. Johnson and produced by Orion Palmer and Slick Eddie Edwards. Like us on Facebook and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Please consider supporting the program either through your podcast platform, click on the link in the description, or on Patreon at Joha Productions. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Paranormal, or you have a recommendation for a guest, contact our producer, Slick Eddie Edwards. Eddie is spelled with a Y at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com.